grab your Bible and head over to Joshua chapter 16. And what we're going to do this week is a single podcast to cover the next 2 weeks, Joshua 16 and 17. And the reason we're doing that is because 16 is pretty short, and Jeff likes 16 and 17 together.
Yeah.
They go together.
They are meant to go together.
So it just makes sense that that we do one podcast to cover both chapters. So let's think about 16 and 17 today. We're still in the throes of parceling out the land. And in 16, we're dealing with, well, in 16 and 17, we're dealing with the sons of Joseph. So beyond the obvious, which I think everybody can read this and see, they're dividing up the land. What do they need to be looking for that we may not see as we just read over that part?
Sure. Well, the big thing is, and I think we touched on this a little bit last week when we were looking at that long section on Judah last week, is, you know, number one, you know, Joseph and Judah are the two dominant tribes of Israel. And you'll notice in chapter 16, and verse 1, it's the allotment to the people of Joseph. Ephraim and Manasseh are Joseph's sons. And so this goes all the way back to the struggles in Genesis, just a quick 10-second, 20-second recap. Struggles in Genesis were really between Joseph and Judah when you read the stories carefully.
Right.
And eventually Joseph gets the birthright, even though Judah will get the scepter, as Jacob, the patriarch, hands out the blessings and prophesies the future of his sons. And so because Joseph gets the birthright as the firstborn of Rachel, he gets a double portion, which is why it's two tribes of Manasseh. And that's how we just look at the map, memorize the list as kids. But you'll notice in the text, this is treated here in chapter 16, verse 1. The allotment to the people of Joseph, and the same thing then when we get to chapter 17, like in verse 17 of chapter 17. So Joshua said to the house of Joseph, to Ephraim and Manasseh.
Right.
So we're not used to thinking of it that way, but it's really the tribe of Judah versus the tribe of Joseph.
Yeah, Joseph is kind of lost after Genesis,
other than
the couple of reference to his bones. And then
when
you get into the judges and the United Kingdom, it's Ephraim and Manasseh. We almost lose sight of the fact that they're tied back to Joseph.
Yeah, that they are really the tribe of Joseph. And this prefigures everything from Genesis, right, the struggle between the brothers, you know, back when they were, there was the brothers themselves were alive. Here, you know, now we're reminded again by the way Joshua, the text of Joshua, divvies up the land. The two dominant tribes get it first, and then chapter 18, you know, everybody else gets something. And so it's still about Judah and Joseph, though Judah comes first now because even though Joseph got the double portion, Judah is the future. The way that the book of Joshua is inspired to tell the story, Judah's the future. The scepter's coming through Judah, but there's still Joshua. And then this prefigures as we get into Kings, the split. This literally, the split is really Judah and Joseph. The Northern Kingdom will become known as Ephraim, you know, is one of the major names, which is the dominant tribe of Joseph.
Right.
You know, within Joseph, Ephraim is kind of the dominant of
Ephraim.
Even
in the prophets, you see that language.
Correct. And part of that goes back to, and you'll notice even here in 16 and 17, Ephraim goes first and then Manasseh as it's all being kind of handled. And that's partly, you know, again, goes back to Genesis, always goes back to Genesis. Jacob, you know, the birth order was Manasseh and Joseph, or in Ephraim, but in fact, 17 verse 1 makes that point. You know, Manasseh, for he was the firstborn of Joseph, but Ephraim goes first in chapter 16 because Jacob reversed the younger and the older, as was his right, as was the way of God in general. And so Ephraim is still, you'll get into little bits of this Genesis story coming out here. The younger has been elevated over the younger. The younger's been elevated over the older, and that's going to, again, go all the way into the divided kingdom when it's Ephraim, the tribe that's the dominant in the northern kingdom once the split finally happens.
So that's interesting and a reminder of how the Bible is knitting together one story.
Well, you like to make that, you know, when you talk about evidences and inserts for the Bible, right? All these connections and
yes, by independent writers writing at different times and yet, you start to realize the deeper you get into your study of the book, the more that is there connecting the stories together.
Yeah, it really is a seamless story if we watch the details carefully and figure out what the major themes are and big ideas are. Then, the level of consistent storytelling Which makes sense if it's not really being written by individual men carrying different traditions over different times for various political purposes. If it's really the Spirit of God,
right,
the same Spirit of God moving various men over the centuries to add the next chapters, the next books to God's story to mankind. So yeah,
it's hard to conceive how the Bible could have been written as it is, absent some kind of controlling hand through the whole process.
Yeah.
That really is an answer for a question for the critic to answer. You know, how does all this end up knit together?
Right.
If these guys are indeed just sort of working solo,
yeah,
on their own, that's really hard to conceive. The other thing that should be noted, I think, in this reading, and we've been harping on this theme, but we've been harping on it because the book of Joshua keeps bringing us back as a setup, I think, for what's coming, to the fact that they didn't finish the job. And so
right,
we see that at the end of 16, they didn't drive out the Canaanites who lived in Gezer, so the Canaanites lived in the midst of Ephraim to this day, and they became forced laborers. And so now, instead of purifying the land, getting out the evil influences, and probably more importantly, inflicting the punishment and the judgment of God, as
right,
God intended, these people are in their midst, which was what God was concerned about all
right
along. And
right,
then you go on ahead in 17:13, it came about when the sons of Israel became strong, they put the Canaanites to forced labor, and they did not drive them out completely. So
right,
again, same kind of thing.
Ephraim and Manasseh are both indicted, you know, as different sections of the family of Joseph for participating in this in their various regions that they receive. Yep.
And then that point is made in a different way at the very end in verse 18,
right,
for you shall drive out the Canaanites, even though they have chariots of iron and though they are strong. And so there it's not really commenting on whether they did the job or not, but that they were to do the job.
Well, right. And it almost seems like Joshua's pushing back on their excuse-making, because you go back a couple verses before to verse 16, the people of Joseph have said to Joshua, the hill country is not enough for us, yet all the Canaanites who dwell in the plain have chariots of iron, both those in Bethshan and its villages and those in the valley of Jezreel. So they're basically saying the people of the land are too strong for us, which is why we need you to adjust some allotments here, some boundaries. Mm-hmm. And Joshua will agree in the sense that you are numerous people. You shall not have one allotment only, you know, but you need to clear out the people who are there. Quit worrying about, you know, the apparent military strength, because chariots of iron were a cutting edge weapon in that time.
Right.
This literally is the time of the transition from the in archaeological, what we call, you know, Bronze Age to Iron Age One in archaeological terms. And so, yeah, that was a cutting edge just coming online, you know. You know, it's like when stealth technology was first revealed to exist a couple decades ago, you know, right, just, you know, kind of a game changer. And so, yeah, they were intimidated. They were or at least making excuses on the basis of they have some of the best new tech on the battlefield.
It would be interesting, and you saying they use this as an excuse, it kind of stirs me to think about what other excuses may have been given for why they don't finish the job.
Yeah.
And you know, obviously here there's some fear about the opponents, which they had no right to fear the opponents.
Or perhaps just laziness. You know, right? We're tired of fighting.
Well, I wondered about that. I wondered mm-hmm. about just the sheer, you know, we've been the sheer, you know, fatigue
yeah.
of all the wandering for years and years. And now the battles in the lands and getting everything conquered and the, you know, kind of the desire they had to just be done and to settle. I imagine a lot of people felt that way during World War II when the victory was won in Europe and those soldiers had been fighting over there for a long time. And they're like, no, man, I don't want to go to the Pacific.
Yeah, now we get to go island hopping.
I don't have to deal with the Japanese too,
right?
And so, you know, one more battle to wage. And I wonder, too, if there could have been some of this justification that, look, we're dominating these people.
Right.
They're working for us now.
Right. That's because you got to remember, right? They've essentially secured dominion over the land. This is, you know, releasing tribes to mop up duty within their territories. And so, look, if we've already achieved, you know, dominance of the region, do we really have to do this?
And the reason I see great value in thinking about that is because it's very, very easy, especially in a snapshot of time, to insert human wisdom
yeah.
and say, I know this isn't what God said, but for this moment and this time, it would be easier to do it this way. This looks like a better route to us. And, of course, you don't really get the problem here until the story plays out and you get into Judges and you realize there's, you know, hundreds of years there of turmoil and trouble because they didn't take the extra time and continue the work and finish as God said to do. So, you know, it kind of gets back to this idea that God has a reason for his instructions. And what's fundamentally underneath all of this is, do I trust him and do I believe his way is right? And trust him enough, you know, to persevere and continue, even maybe when my own wisdom might, I see a better way or an easier way out.
Right. And then the real tragedy is, if my memory serves me correctly, I think, you know, some of this territory where it's said, you know, that they left the Canaanites and didn't drive them out. If I'm not mistaken, Pharaoh in Solomon's day, when Solomon is marrying Pharaoh's daughter, you know, Pharaoh will actually take some of this land and give it to Solomon as a gift, you know, kind of part of the daughter's dowry when he marries the Egyptian princess, which, of course, Solomon wasn't supposed to do anyway. So just, you know, kind of the whole thing compounds itself. And the irony is eventually an Egyptian Pharaoh will be the one to technically subdue some of this and then hand it off to Solomon. So, you know, it's just, yeah. And of course, we know how the Solomon story goes.
Yeah. Idolatry has always been a problem for them. And throughout their history, it was a problem for them. And you would think that, you know, here was the moment we could have dealt with that, and we didn't. We left it.
Had momentum.
Yes.
Had experience.
We left the idolater there, and look what's happened. The other thing that occurs to me is, and I'm probably getting ready to bait Jeff when I say this, so I apologize for that.
I'll try not to fall for it.
But the, you know, the struggle that God's people have always had with culture.
Oh,
you know,
yeah,
that's
yeah.
not new yeah. to 2026 America.
No.
That God's people have always had this battle not to conform to the nations around them. In fact, when we get to the king part, you know, in 1 Samuel and Israel saying, you know, we want a king so we can be like the nations, right? And so, again, they're not saying, God, what do you want for us? They're saying, here's what we want because we want to be like the nations.
And right.
It's just amazing how that struggle has been present today, and it's been present all the way down through time.
Well, it's funny, when you frame it that way, it's not just culture, it's also human nature. Human nature is consistent, and at least part of the potential piece of human nature you can kind of see in this as well is we don't like to deal with problems that don't seem like they're imminent threats.
Yeah.
You know, and so we tolerate a little bit of spiritual mischief, you know, things that don't seem to be a big deal. We don't make a mountain out of a molehill. And it really becomes a leaven in our life or in a congregation's life because it doesn't seem like it's that big a deal. We, you know, we're not drifting doctrinally. We haven't compromised on some big practice or work of the church. You know, this is a seemingly small moral thing to kind of wink at, blink at, whatever. Nobody's perfect, you know, whatever. And so we tend to tolerate a little bit of the Canaanite, so to speak, left around us, among us, because it doesn't seem like it's that big of a deal, because otherwise we're doing pretty good, you know, no glaring moral failures, no glaring deviations in the, you know, in what, you know, how we live versus what the Bible says, and we tolerate just that little bit.
Yep.
That eventually does kind of like, you know, these stories remind us, these are the seeds of issues centuries down the road. You may not, you know, go any further with some of this, your kids will.
Yeah.
You know, human nature.
I don't really think I thought or recognized how much this is in Joshua. Usually when I think about the corruption of the surrounding nations, you're thinking Judges, because that's where all of that kind of blows up.
Right.
But it would be something, as we're working these chapters, especially, you know, as maybe you struggle with some of the place names and the dividing of the territory.
That's right.
To be watching for this thread that's running through this, because the writer's building to something, and that is, this is getting ready to blow up on them, and we're going to see that as we continue to go through these two books this year.
Now, there's one other thing, though, we do want to put on the table. Just like Judah had Caleb, you know, ultimately both North and South are going to fall away, right? And Caleb is going to, you know, Caleb kind of represents the righteous remnant within Judah. The daughters of Zelophehad in chapter 70 represent that righteous remnant in the North. You know, even in the North, there were, you know, Elijah's a prophet of the North. You know, some of those, there was a righteous remnant. And so you do have from the book of Numbers, the daughters of Zelophehad's coming up saying, we want our inheritance, you know, kind of the female Caleb version of, you know, let me at him.
Right.
We want this inheritance. Make sure we get our inheritance, you know. And so,
yeah, not everybody failed.
No.
In fact, that's even going to come out in Judges. Some did, some didn't.
Yeah. There's always that righteous remnant. Yeah. even in some of the most God-forsaken places, and some of the places we think are the most devoid of God-fearing religion. So
Okay. So some things to ponder this week as we work on 16 and 17, and in 2 weeks we'll be back with a podcast on 18.